Hello, my name is Phil Blancato. I am CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Welcome to another weekly update on the latest with the coronavirus, the spread of the virus, and more importantly, the impact of the virus on the economy, the stock market, and the bond market. To start off, let's hope you had a wonderful Independence Day. Hopefully you had a chance to spend time with your friends and family, socially distant and maybe wearing masks, but certainly a chance to relax and spend a little time with people that you care about. When you go into the latest data, there's no doubt there's a concern around the most recent spike of the virus. Certainly, there's reasons for concern. When you think about what's happened lately, the four big states, California, Texas, Arizona, and Florida, all are seeing new daily cases that are higher than at any time since the virus began. Additionally, when you look at the country as a whole, topping 60,000 cases just yesterday, there is definitely reasons for pause. As we watch the reopening of the economies around the country, different states, different locations, now being very uneven. In fact, some states, like the four I mentioned, are beginning to pull back, limiting opportunities in bars and restaurants. When I think about the time I spent in Texas a few weeks back, certainly I was surprised coming from New York at how many people were, to be quite honest with you, somewhat reluctant to wear masks in an open setting. And unfortunately, now they're to a degree we're seeing a spike in cases, which has been somewhat significant from the idea that we are seeing a number of younger people being infected on a fairly rapid basis. In fact, in most cases, the number of new infections range anywhere from 50 to 75% of the people between the ages of 20 and 54 years old. So there's no doubt that we are seeing a spike in cases. When we go a level deeper and begin to think about the effect of these cases on hospitals, as of now, we are seeing a marginal increase in hospitals. In fact, in some of the four I mentioned, in certain locations, the availability of ICU beds or extreme care beds are getting more and more limited. So it's not to say that younger people are not affected by the virus. They are. By and large, however, we're still not at an urgent situation. It could very well be that, for example, in Florida, where 83% of the beds are now being used in the ICU, that went from last week there was 1,400 free ICU beds, and now there's 1,000, so 400 additional people in just the last week. Certainly, there's a reason for concern that if the situation worsens, we would have a scenario where now we have extreme pressure on hospitals. And as we've talked about in the past, one of the things that could clearly cause us to lock back down or slow down the reopening would be a surge in hospitals patients that affects our ability to manage the situation, whereas anyone who gets sick, not just COVID, won't have somewhere to go. And that really is the underlying theme. When I get into these calls and I talk so often about the virus, I feel regret sometimes that I'm not connecting the dots between the data of the virus and why I'm talking so much about it. Certainly when I'm talking about the implications, there's two aspects of it. There's the human toll, the tragic human toll of people passing away. And then there's the impact of the virus, its spread, and how it infects the overall economy. So when I look at areas like Texas that had a 50,000 person jump in just the last week, on one hand, there's some comfort in that the people who are getting sick are younger. And up until this point, 73% of the deaths in Texas were people over the age of 65. But that does mean quite a few people of the 2,700 people that passed away in Texas, roughly 2,000 of them were over the age of 65, which are tragic that people are losing their lives. So I guess we could take some solace that the people who are getting sick now may be less likely to pass away. And in fact, the death rates in Texas have been relatively the same, almost unchanged from the beginning of this. We're also seeing that the number of people going into the ICU was less. For example, 9,286 people went into the hospital due to COVID, up from 6,533, so almost about 3,000 people more. Yet the ICU beds only went up from 1,485 free beds last week to 1,148 this week, so adding about 400 more people to the ICU. So the vast preponderance of people are not going to the ICU, and that's some belief that that's because folks are younger. When I think about it, Arizona, where they've added over 80,000 cases, a very similar scenario, where 50% of the people in the ICU today are due to COVID. However, in actual number of people, that's about 600 people. However, hospital use, number of people in the hospital that are now in the hospital because of COVID is up over 3,000 when that number was just 1,500 but a few weeks ago. So people going into the hospital, but not everybody into the ICU. Why that's relevant as we look at whether Texas is going to shut down completely or Arizona is going to shut down completely, there's some hope that as the new cases ebb, and we are in the last 7 days seeing a flattening to a minor ebbing in places like Texas and Arizona, and even to a small degree Florida. The last few days have been better. And I would assume that's because in all these states, now there is a requirement to wear a mask, to close bars and restaurants to a degree, to allow only outside dining, and follow the steps that some other states have taken where they've had, as of recent, much less of an impact. Even in Florida, one of the most significant states, 60,000 people in the last week alone. When we look at the data there, well, very consistent. The bulk of the people here were over the age of 85, but of the new cases in the last 3 weeks, the bulk of them are between the ages of 20 and 64, or 86% of the cases. So it's a very consistent theme. The one state that really stands out is California, where California is adding a number of new people to the hospital. The number of people in the hospital has increased, but not significantly. And then go one further, what we're seeing in California is the number of ICU beds available from last week to this week actually went down. They had 3,900 ICU beds available this past week when it was only 3,700 the week before. So the hospitalizations increased by about 5%, but the ICU bed only increased about 2%, and some people got better and left the hospital. So kudos to California for managing it fairly well. However, the number of new total increases is up over 60,000. So it remains to be seen as we go through this, are these folks going to not get really sick? Are we not going to put pressure on the hospital system? And are we not going to see the death rates spike? Or is the opposite going to happen? In somewhat remembrance of New York, where nearly over 18,000 people passed away. And while the vast majority of them were over the age of 65, that's a significant number of people. Just think of comparison. In just New York City, over 18,600 people passed away. And in the entire state of Texas, it's 2,700 people. Arizona, 1,900 people. Florida, 3,500 people. And California, 6,400 people. If you roll all these states up together, they don't actually pass the number of people that have passed away in just New York City. So hopefully lessons learned in New York about social distancing play out here, and we're able to manage this virus spread and hopefully begin to reduce it again, which has obviously the human benefit, but as importantly, the economic benefit for us opening the country and getting folks back to work and being able to re-engage and earn money again to provide for their families and their lifestyles. When you look around the globe, there's definitely some reason to believe that things are getting marginally better. Besides Brazil, Russia, and the United States, most other countries are doing pretty well. In fact, what we saw was the death rate, which could have been as high as 8,000 people a day passing away globally. It's now down to anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000. It was trending down significantly lower. And then, unfortunately, because of Brazil and Russia, we're seeing a bit of a spike there, and to a small degree, the United States. The United States has had an exceptional death rate. We have had days where we had under 500 on numerous times, and generally, we're now below 1,000 people per day, between 500 to 1,000. So what we've seen in the U.S., is that our death rate is very low. In fact, in comparison to Europe, we have 134,000 people that have passed away, where Europe has 195,000 passed away. But we have over 3.1 million people have gotten sick, where they have 2.5 million. So kudos to our hospital system, who have learned to intubate people on their stomachs. In most cases, don't intubate at all. Use some of the new therapeutics to help people, and use different therapies like plasma to help get people out of the hospital, or remdesivir, which is a drug that's now available and working. Pile all this together, and there's no doubt we're not quite there yet. In some degree, I'm jealous of Europe. I've got a lot of family overseas, and when I look at how well they've done, it really is impressive. When you think about places like Taiwan that haven't had any new cases from existing relationships in the country in 78 days. Wow, that's amazing. Imagine if we were in that scenario. Or New Zealand, where they basically conquered the virus and had some people come back into the country that lived there and brought it with them. But other than that, no new cases. Australia, minor spikes. Estonia, 12 new infections in the past 2 weeks. New Zealand, as I mentioned, really very little, if nothing, going on. Vietnam, only people that are coming in from visiting abroad causing it. So there are other countries that have done significantly better than us. And I guess keeping politics out of that. Maybe that's a combination of doing it at the state level versus the federal level, but I'm not sure we would have appreciated having done a federal level because all our states are somewhat different. In any event, we are not like the other countries as of yet, except from our death cycle. The number of people passing away has been improving, and that's one ray of sunshine amongst, you know, concerns this week. That there definitely is a concern of the number of people getting sick and whether or not we can control this, and then how it will affect the overall economy and whether or not we slow down. But for a minute, let's take a step back. The quarter did just end. And now we're here we are through the second quarter. And while the virus is spiking, I think there is reason to look back at what's happened from the economic standpoint, because the most recent data economically is really pretty strong. When I think about what happened in the second quarter, you know, it's somewhat powerful to remember that we had the S&P 500 up 20.5%, the best quarter performance since 1998. The Dow Jones was up over 18.5%, the best quarter since 1987. The NASDAQ up over 31%, the best quarter since 1999. When I think about where the S&P is compared to where it was, it's almost incredible to think how far we've come. Remember, we were down over 34% from the very peak of the market to where we ended up. And here we are today, just down about 1.5% on the year. But there's a little bit more to that picture. If you look at the S&P 500 on an equally weighted basis, it's still down around 11% on the year. So all stocks looking at them at the same weight, not just the biggest companies. If for a minute I focus on just the top 10 stocks, believe it or not, they're up 10% on the year. The top 50 stocks in the S&P 500 are up 2%. However, stocks between 200 and 250 are down 9% on the year. And the bottom 50 in the S&P 500 are still down 39% on the year. So when it comes to managing money, we need to be aware that there's a very narrow market right now. There's a handful of companies, you know them, the Microsofts and the Amazon and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, are the ones really driving the overall stock market higher. But it has been a very unusual year. The idea being that you really can't time the market. Being in a diversified portfolio of assets is the key to long-term success, and that's played out in the first quarter. Because you might remember way back when I talked about the type of recession that we're in, and I described it as an event-driven recession, not one that's structural like we had in 2008 when the banks broke down, not one that's cyclical, just to, you know, over time economies wear down and kind of got to take a breather and then start again. This one's, and by the way, cyclical would be something like the early 80s. An event-driven one is one we were, you know, this was recently termed a recession as an event suppression or an event recession suppressed, meaning that this was forced upon us. And usually the good part about an event-driven recession, it's they're the shortest. They're the ones that usually last only two quarters and tend to have the quickest market rebound. Well, that's exactly what's played out here. That, in fact, up until now, we're looking at two quarters of recession. The third quarter of this year has projections of growth between 25 to 35%. They've come down a bit recently because of the additional recent shutdowns that we're going through and the new spread of the virus, but certainly a very positive outlook for what's happening. And that's critical because why we recognize that is, you remember 2008, we had a very prolonged period of time when people continued to be laid off. And it started in early 2008, and it went all the way to December of 2009 when we saw layoffs continuing to happen. And interestingly enough, as soon as the layoffs stopped happening in December of 2009, we saw the market begin to really rally forward. And that's that pickup that happened in 2009 and going forward. Same scenario here. The jobs market cooled off in basically June of 2020. That was the peak of the jobs being claimed, meaning people asking to be people leaving the workforce. That was the highest mark we saw so far. And since that, every day we've seen more people go back to work. And in a scenario like that, it's usually the bottom of the market when the market really begins to grind higher. But two things to know from there, that event-driven recessions tend to be short. And the one thing that can change that is if the virus spread becomes more significant. If we have to go back into a lockdown, then this becomes a structural recession and it's a very different ballgame. As of now, that's not the case. And the other thing to remember is by owning a balanced account, having good quality bonds in your portfolio, owning high quality equities in your portfolio, it helped really mitigate some of the loss that we saw and helped you recover more quickly. So there is value in a diversified portfolio. And when I think back about that really unusual time we saw in February, it wasn't that different in 2008. There's a lot of a lot of things that were similar to it. We saw panic selling, a sideways market for a while, and then a methodical grind higher as the economy improved, which is what we're going through here. Now, the market is anticipating a vaccine or an antivirus, a therapeutic to get us through this. And we certainly don't have one yet, and I'll talk about those in just a minute. But the most recent economic data is reasons to be excited. There's reasons to finally believe that there's some support from these very lofty valuations we're seeing on the S&P 500. Remember, the equity market, both the Dow and the S&P, are grinding significantly higher. We're almost back to even on the year, and yet we have millions of people out of work. We have an economy that's going to have the worst economic contraction in our lifetime. We are adding billions of dollars to the debt level, and yet the stock market is, trillions of dollars to the debt level, and yet the stock market's back to an all-time high. And that's because of the stock market forecast out anywhere from 6 months to a year to 2 years to 3 years of what it expects to happen. So in the forecasting of the future, the stock market believes our economic data is going to improve and justify current stock prices. And to a small degree, that's happening. For example, on May 31st, 350,000 people went through TSA that day. On July the 5th, 732,000, so an improvement. Now again, this current correction, or this current spike in the virus may slow that down, but that is nearly a double. Gasoline usage was down 50% back in April. Now it's down 10% year over year. The number of people that have gotten their job back, we added 4.8 million jobs in June. That was a massive number. The unemployment rate fell all the way to 11% from 20%. In fact, when we look at the labor market, it's probably the most startling of them all, that the labor market significantly improved, more so than really anybody expected. And in fact, when you get into the data, what we're finding is that not only did we add 4.8 million people back in, the number of jobs were pretty broad-based. We saw the biggest leap in May in the retail and hospitality industry. Now, this time around, in the June, the number was much more broad-based. Places like manufacturing, retail, saw a sizable boost. And in fact, this was when we look at the data, from February to April, nearly 22 million jobs were lost. Over the past 2 months, 7.5 million jobs have returned. Now, we have a long way to go, but that certainly is a real improvement. The number of people being employed in the marketplace is back to a relatively good number, meaning our participation rate, and the number of jobs available is back up around 5.5 million. So signs that we're seeing a real improvement in the labor market, which is part of the reason why the stock market has done so well as of late. In fact, The labor market statistics were a bit of a grand slam, to be quite honest with you, because we were expecting a much lower number. We're expecting unemployment to still be around 13%, and now it fell all the way down to 11%. Add to that, there's some other really pretty good numbers. Consumer confidence is back up again, up around 90. That's a scale of 50 to 130, so we're seeing a nice spike in consumer confidence. I'm sorry, back up to 98, forgive me. Our manufacturing sector is now in expansion mode. Now, it's coming off a significant contraction, but any number above 50 from a scale of 40 to 60 basically means we're in growth mode, in expansion mode, not contraction mode. And then the most important part of our economy, the portion of our economy that really is so critical to us, is how much we, the consumers, are expanding. And we saw our, what we call the ISM services sector, expand all the way up to 58. So a real improvement in the consumer, from the idea that the consumer suddenly is starting to feel pretty good again. And they actually spent quite a bit of money. Our year-over-year spending in most states is only down anywhere from 10 to 20% now. So we are seeing a significant improvement in the what we call the non-manufacturing sector, or the services sector, which is critical because the consumer is 70% of our economy. As long as the consumer spends, we will continue to grow, or at least hold on. Another area is homes. When you look at home valuations are actually up 5% year over year. New mortgage applications were up 5% just last week and up 33% year over year. Those are real gains in the housing sector. And housing matters. When our house holds up in value, it matters to how much we're worth. And more importantly, it gives us great confidence in the future of the economy. So as bad as things were, they've improved marginally here. And for that reason, it sounds like, you know, we really have an opportunity to hold on. And the reason why I mentioned hold on is not necessarily grow. Hold on from the idea that the Federal Reserve has come in and really pumped a lot of money into the economy. And in that sense, it's bought us time to find an antivirus, to find a vaccine, to get us to the point where maybe we can get through this pandemic in a way that allows us to grow again rather than contract. I have a friend who runs a little Italian cafe. Her name is Rosalba. And she finally got her PPP loan. It was actually over $30,000. And it gives her the money to stay afloat for the year, or really the 6 months that she needed to pay her rent, to support her employees, because her revenues were so far down. Those kind of actions at the personal level, or at the federal level, or at the company level, have made a profound difference. And there's more than likely a second round of stimulus coming, as well as an extension of the PPP loans, because of the success so far has proven that we're not quite there yet, and more than likely the federal government's going to have to agree on some measure of stimulus going forward. Now, not everything's rosy. As I mentioned already, we still have millions of people out of work. You know, when you think about the total number of people looking for work, you know, there's something to the tune of anywhere from, because not everyone's counted, you could argue it's anywhere from 12 million to 20 million people really looking for work. It's millions of people, because some are out of the workforce now. Separately and aside, our earnings of U.S. corporations are going to be the worst in our lifetime. We're expecting a 43% decline in earnings for the second quarter. And so far, what we're seeing from earnings growth is down just 6%, but only 16 companies have reported. So we're expecting some really horrific numbers. So whether it's unemployment, company growth, growth of the United States, the numbers for the second quarter are going to be really hard to understand. And yet, even though the stock market's up higher, we need growth to justify that. And we're certainly not going to get a lot of that in the second quarter. So let's not sit here and believe that all the data is wonderful, because certainly some of the data isn't wonderful. And the Federal Reserve have helped us by stimulating the U.S. economy, by giving people money that have gotten us here. So when you put it all together, the economic data definitely has improved. And that's what's driven the market higher. There's a handful of stocks that are the big winners in all this. And I think it's to be commended of how well they've done in keeping us going. Could you imagine where we'd be if Amazon wasn't around and we're having to go out into the public and buy all our stuff? How easy it is to stay safe and healthy right now. Could you imagine if Microsoft wasn't around and the ability for to be in the cloud and pull all our data? What if Zoom wasn't around? What if I couldn't be on a Zoom call and be able to get you the information that you need or our clients need? And so on. We get in a scenario where our technology has really allowed us to be able to do some things we've never done before, whether it's shopping or working or just managing our lifestyles in a way that we've never done before. And it's actually been pretty darn effective. You know, we're not growing like we were, but we're certainly maintaining. And there's something to be said for that. And it came through in the data for the second quarter. And I think that's what the real big positive is here. So let's switch to the virus for a few minutes again. We talked about the caseload. Now let's just talk a little bit about the vaccines. Well, there's no doubt that there's some really wild things going on out there. And the first one that I've noticed is that, believe it or not, there are 150 different vaccines that are coming to market. Some of those are therapeutics. At least 150. You could argue there's even more when you think about some of the things that don't require significant testing, like plant-based therapeutics. But each of these, and some of the big ones like Moderna is a company I've talked about, or Roche, or Johnson & Johnson, or BioNTech, or the University of Oxford coupled with AstraZeneca, are looking for 30,000 people for each one who can be candidates to test it. We are about to enter phase three on multiple fronts. And believe it or not, it's going to be somewhat problematic to find all the people we need. Because one, you got to be in hotspots where there's a lot of cases. Two, you got to find people who are willing to do it. Three, you got to have people who can't be in the same study at the same time. And four, you got to find a way to recruit them. It's actually quite complicated because you want folks who are elderly, you want folks from different races, you want folks who are younger, you want all different aspects. And believe it or not, it's actually quite difficult to find all these people because never in our history have we had this many vaccines come to market at one time. It really is somewhat incredible that we're having a somewhat of a lack of people to meet all these requirements. Think of Europe. There's multiple cities that have very small cases right now, so they don't have any active cases. You just got to inoculate people who don't have it and see if they eventually get it. It makes it somewhat challenging. Now, Brazil, the United States, Russia, there are places where we can test. Great Britain is having a bit of a spike. But certainly it's just something to think about when, you know, the reality of getting so many vaccines to market at one time. How do we do so in a way that allows us to make sure that it works and it's healthy and it's safe? It's kind of an unusual, unintended consequence of so many companies racing to help everybody out at this quote-unquote warp speed. But just some quick updates on these. Roche and Merck, excuse me, both have existing drugs that they're repurposing. Remember, we've talked a little bit about the repurposing of existing drugs, and there's been some really good news on that front. But they now have Roche has an arthritis drug called Rooctemra, and Merck has one called Rebif, that both are either arthritis drugs or multiple sclerosis that they think can help bring down inflammation in the lungs and help people get to get out of the hospital sooner. And by the way, I think that there's not a lot of studies on this, but there's got to be something to the fact that these existing drugs, the Gilead Remdesivir drug, these drug using plasma, the new steroid that's been used very effectively. There's something to be said that these things could also be keeping our death rate low and hopefully keep some of the pressure off hospitals. Sinovac, a Chinese company, is now inoculating people in Brazil in a phase 3 trial. They've hired 9,000 people in Brazil to do that. Brazil's having a tough time of things, so actually much worse than us. So it's great to see that there's maybe some relief there. Johnson & Johnson is now partnering with a company based out of Maryland to produce millions of vials of their vaccine for $500 million offer that they think that by 2021 can have millions of vials available for the United States and globally. That's another effort to produce a vaccine that can be used everywhere. A new American company that's been on the scene, I mentioned them in the past, but have taken a real leap forward. Novavax is now partnered with the federal government and received a $1.6 billion grant from Operation Warp Speed to create 100 million doses of their vaccine. They're going to use them mostly for the military, but very far advanced in going into phase 3 trials. Sanofi just struck a deal in Britain to create millions of doses of their vaccine with GlaxoSmithKline, 60 million doses. A new American company out of San Francisco, Vaxarat. It's a vaccine developer that's actually inoculating monkeys and believe they have a standard pill that'll be a vaccine. So not a needle, not intravenous. They have a pill that can survive at room temperature that they believe can work and also receive money from Operation Warp Speed to get their testing up and running, or get their move them into phase 1 trials. A new test coming out of the Arizona State Biodesign Institute, a saliva test you can do at home, protecting healthcare workers and allowing you to cough into a bag, believe it or not, or use a swab to be able to send in your own saliva to see if you have it at a very inexpensive rate. Plasma continues to be an area of success in that as long as the patient can get the plasma within the first few days of getting very sick, it can have an impact on whether or not they can recover. One of the hard parts for plasma is for every 500,000 people that donate plasma, only 200,000 of those people, their plasma can be used because they got to make sure there's enough antibodies in there to make it work. That's a little bit of a hard catch-22 when it comes to plasma. But certainly another tool in the toolbox to help in certain situations. Mesoblast has a stem cell they can believe it help especially younger people when they have a inflammatory syndrome that's similar to COVID. Maybe you've heard about sometimes younger people get this inflammatory virus, like a Coxsackie virus, similar to COVID, but maybe not exactly the same, cardiovascular and inflammatory. They believe their stem cell treatment can help prevent that. That's new to market as well. And then two more that are interesting, and I'll start with an odd one first. Hydroxychloroquine has made another comeback. It seemed like that one had been left behind, that it just wasn't affected. But a recent study from the Henry Ford Health System shows that of the 2,500 patients that have been hospitalized in six different hospitals, 13% of them, the study found that 30% of the patients treated passed away. 26% of the patients who did not receive the drug passed away. But the others, so in other words, 87% improved significantly from the drug. So this one's a bit of a political football. I don't know whether this one's coming or going, but this is the first positive result after a few negative results. So we'll leave that one out there as an unknown. Probably one of the most exciting pieces of news is Regeneron. Regeneron is a company I've talked about a few times. Regeneron is a company that's working on a therapeutic. And I think therapeutics are critical because it's a way to get people better without having to go to the hospital as soon as they get the disease. So in other words, you take a pill and in 24 to 48 hours later, you're better. Now, Regeneron is, believe it or not, moving at, again, lightning speed. They have a drug called REGN-COV2. So does Eli Lilly, both using messenger RNA to have a therapeutic that helps you get better for probably 8 to 10 weeks, but more importantly, keeps you out of the hospital. They started this process in early February in phase 1. They quickly were able to jump to phase two here in the last 30 days. They've tested and they have they've already gone through a testing phase where 30 hospitals and non-hospitalized COVID patients received a positive review from an independent study. So using it in multiple hospitals and getting positive results already. The treatment basically is going to have phase two and phase three kick off at the same time. They're going to do that in hospitals in the United States and in Brazil. And the NIHAI, which is National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, is starting phase three with them in conjunction. They believe they can have millions of doses of this ready for us. Are you ready for this? In August or early September. That they are well down the path of something that's not a vaccine, but an antivirus that could really change the trajectory of this disease and give us something that gets people better quickly. Which, when it comes down to, that's the core of it. Whether this is an event-driven recession or a structural one, meaning is this temporary or long-term, is still going to depend on our ability to go back to work and not get people sick. Now, we have realized that the folks who are most vulnerable are older, and it's not to say we don't need to care about them, because of course we do. But can we go back to work in a way that allows us to make sure we're not getting the older folks sick? By the way, only 10% of people of the age 65 actually pass away, so that's not a death sentence, but certainly those are the folks who are dying when they do get it. And when you think about that from that aspect, can we protect those who are most sick or those who have some sort of pre-existing condition? We saw the data in New York City clearly stand out that if you don't have a pre-existing condition and you're not over the age of 65, you got a good chance of going back to work and not getting terribly sick from it. But will you go home and give it to someone who is? Could you pass it to somebody who meets those requirements and suddenly the spread is affecting people again? So that's that tap dance we have to figure out here as we go through the summer months. One of the oddities in this is that, believe it or not, we thought hot temperatures would kill the virus, and it does. Except what do we do in the summer in places like Arizona, Florida, California, and Texas? Well, we go inside the air conditioning. So companies like Honeywell are developing systems that can, with a ultraviolet light, kill the virus as it goes through the air conditioning system. But that's probably part of the reason why we're seeing some of the spread in those places. I think it's a lot more about bars and restaurants, but certainly that has something to do with it. Put it all together, we know where the virus spreads, we know who gets it, we know who's most affected, we know what we can do to slow it down, and now we just need that last pivotal piece, which is not only slowing it down, but then having some sort of vaccine or antiviral that allows us to open up the economy for an extended period of time and really begin to get back to a full-on growth rate to not only keep people from dying, but hopefully grow it a way that helps people get back to fully engaged and be able to provide for their families and themselves. One fun final point. Don't think you're the only ones out there who are struggling with how to deal with wearing a mask. One of my favorite articles over the weekend came out in the Wall Street Journal and talked about at nudist colonies, believe it or not, they have to wear a mask. So while they may be clothing optional resorts, they are in a scenario where they don't always have to wear, they have to wear a mask, but clothing may not be optional. There's the new irony of the day. They get unusual tan lines on their face, but I guess tan everywhere else. Forgive me for the dark humor here, but I did think that was fun. More importantly, wherever you are, I hope you're safe and sound. I hope you're respecting and wearing the mask when you're out in public places. Know that there's lots of proof that it works. Keep yourself safe, keep your family safe by when you're in an unknown public place in a crowded environment, wear a mask. Hopefully you're staying safe and sound. And we'll continue to have these calls. We'll give you some guidance as to where we go from here. Make sure your portfolio is in high quality equities, quality fixed income, in a neutral position, not overweight stocks, not underweight either. We want to participate and protect in an environment like this so that in the end, we'll be able to be a part of the market rallies, but have some awareness that if things don't go as we expect, we have a way to protect our assets as well. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful week and talk to you all real soon. Bye-bye.